It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Democrats in the state assembly took an unusual move in opposition to a new campaign finance law last night. The entire caucus recused itself from the vote, citing a statute that bars public officials from taking action that affects their financial interests.
The law would raise contribution limits to candidates, among other changes that would likely increase the amount of money spent in elections and on issue advocacy. The assembly also voted last night to dismantle the bipartisan Government Accountability Board.
Here with us now is Jesse O'Poyan, state government reporter at the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So you were on site last night at the Capitol as the assembly looked at a bunch of elections-related legislation. What happened last night?
Well, I guess the good news is they could have gone till 11 p.m. and they didn't. But last night, the assembly voted to approve two bills. One of them would reshape the state's campaign finance laws, and the other sort of dismantles and overhauls the Government Accountability Board into two separate commissions that would oversee ethics and election laws.
And there was a bit of drama last night between Republicans and Democrats, primarily over campaign finance bills that were up for votes. And there was something, it sounds like, pretty unusual that happened in that the Democrats recused themselves from a vote. What happened there?
Yeah, that's right. Sort of midway through the debate, after they'd talked about amendments and right before they started debating the final passage of the bill, Representative Corey Mason got up and said that he felt that the bill could have a substantial financial impact on him and his campaign committee, so he needed to recuse himself, and that set off that was clearly a planned effort, but every single Democrat got up one by one and sort of gave the same speech or variations on it, announcing that they would not be voting on it.
Has there been any precedent for a similar recusal that you're aware of?
No, not that I'm aware of, and not that anyone that I talked to last night could think of off the top of their head.
And what was the Republican response to this recusal?
It's pretty uniformly annoyed, I would say. A lot of Republicans accused them of pulling a stunt, making a mockery of the process. Speaker Robin Voss said he'd never been so disappointed in members of the minority. His argument and the argument of a couple others is that, you know, there are a lot of bills that affect legislators or affect their families or affect their hometowns one way or another, and this could, you know, set a precedent to say, well, you'd have to recuse yourself on almost everything you're voting on based on this. You'd have to recuse yourself on the state budget or, you know, something that would affect funding that, you know, might be tied to your hometown, anything like that. And the other argument, I guess, is that if they do recuse themselves, you could never make any changes to campaign finance law.
Yeah, I was following this a bit on Twitter last night as it unfolded, and at one point, Democrat Peter Barca tried to make a comment on it, and a Republican replied, "You can't talk, you're recused." It sounds as though it got pretty heated.
It did. It did get a little heated. That was sort of as things were drawing to a close, and Speaker Voss was talking, and Peter Barca asked if he could ask a question, and he was silenced on that, noted that he had already been recused, and he shouted back a little bit later that, you know, his recusal didn't take away that his right to ask a question. And there's a little bit of shouting.
Now let's go over a bit what the bill contains. What are the changes that would be made under this bill?
Sure. So the bill would it would double contribution limits for state and local offices. It would allow candidates to work very closely to coordinate with advocacy groups that don't have to say where their money's coming from. It would also allow corporations and unions to give money sort of on equal levels to political parties and campaign committees. The argument in favor of it is it's sort of bringing things up to speed with a lot of the recent court rulings, both at the state and at the federal level, governing some of these campaign finance rules that Wisconsin's code just doesn't really line up with anymore.
What did you think about what the Democrats had to say about the substance of these bills? We know that they were objecting to aspects of it in their recusal, that they didn't want to vote yesterday, but what did they say about their opposition and why they were opposed?
Sure, the opposition is, they believe that, I think especially sort of the three combined, will create an environment, sort of a perfect storm, to allow the influence of money in politics to expand significantly. The common theme that you kept hearing was that this opens the door for corruption. You know, if more money is coming in from corporations or from entities that don't have to disclose it, and if the board, the accountability board that oversees all of these rules is going through changes, you know, maybe the watchdog isn't there to the same degree to make sure that corruption isn't happening. And then I know we're going to talk about the John Doe law, that factors into it too.
We're talking with the Capital Times' Jesse O'Poin right now, and looking at action on several elections-related bills last night at the Capitol. And you mentioned John Doe, so let's go there next, Jesse. So this is one that had already cleared the Assembly initially. How did this one come into play last night?
So this one had to be discussed again a little bit last night because of some procedural issues between the Assembly and the Senate. But what the bill does is sort of alter the scope and the way that John Doe investigations can be implemented. So it limits, so these, you know, secret John Doe investigations could only be conducted for the most severe felonies and some violent crimes. And the Democratic objection to that is that it could no longer cover things like campaign finance and ethics violations.
And what did the Senate want changed about the Assembly version?
Well, what ended up happening was the Assembly refused to message their version over to the Senate the night before, and the Senate had its midnight vote. So it was not changes in substance. It was just changes in getting the versions to line up.
So nothing of substance in the bill changed, but it had to be brought up one more time.
Right.
Well, finally, let's take a look at changes to the Government Accountability Board. This has been another very hot topic in the legislature. What was the latest from last night there?
Yeah, so this one the current board is, you know, it oversees both ethics and elections laws, and it's governed by a board of nonpartisan retired judges. So this new model would split it into two boards, one overseeing election law, one overseeing ethics rules. The appointees on those boards would be bipartisan, so they would have partisan affiliations, but they would be balanced out between Democrats and Republicans. One of the big takeaways I think that Democrats objected to on this is that the board would have to seek approval from the Joint Finance Committee in order to conduct any investigations that cost more than $25,000. So Democrats were concerned that they could be asking for money for investigations from the people that could potentially be under investigation.
Right. That was one point that came up last night. What else, what other shape did that debate take last night about the Government Accountability Board?
I think the other argument against it from the Democratic side was that these commissions would, to a degree, not have a lot of power. I guess they would be toothless watchdogs, toothless lapdogs, they say, rather than watchdogs. A lot of the conversation circled back to the caucus scandal in the 2000s, and you know, that was back when there were those two boards then, and you know, the model changed sort of as a result of that. So Democrats were asking, why go back to that? They argued that this would usher us back into that age. You know, Republicans say it's been a failed experiment. It had good intentions, but it's not doing the things it's supposed to do. It's not following its policies. It's not setting its policies, and it's time for a new model.
And again, just checking out Twitter last night, it looked as the Republican John Nygren had objections to the way the media in Wisconsin had handled Government Accountability Board coverage. What did he say?
Yeah, he specifically praised the National Review, maybe in the Wall Street Journal, who have a lot of their reporting on this has been done through their editorial pages. So that's coming from an opinionated perspective, but they've been breaking some news on it. And he called them out and praised them and was critical of state level media and the way that they treated it, thought that state reporters had maybe been a little too kind to the GAB.
And what is the reception likely to be like in the Senate, Jesse?
Well, it's still a little unclear how things are looking in the Senate. they're looking for changes on the GAB. Some Republicans would like to see a model that maybe includes some of those retired judges, maybe along with some of the citizen appointees. And their campaign finance is a little more unclear. We know that there's things that they're looking to change, but we don't exactly know what they are. But there's a committee vote on both of the bills this afternoon that'll maybe give us a little more insight on that.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jesse O'Poyne, state government reporter at the Capital Times, about votes in the state assembly last night on elections law.
There's been a lot of talk in Wisconsin lately about brain drain, when young people get their education in Wisconsin but leave once they graduate, taking their talent with them.
Our next guest wrote a letter to the editor at the Capital Times in Madison to explain his decision to leave the state for graduate school, even though he was accepted at UW-Madison.
Paul Aaron's got his undergraduate degree at UW-Green Bay. He's currently a Cornell University graduate student. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start with your background. Are you from Wisconsin originally?
I came from a military family, so I moved up and down the east coast of the U.S. most of my life, but ended up in Wisconsin in 2002 after my dad retired from the military. And I've been in Green Bay specifically ever since 2005 until 2015 when I just moved.
And do you think of Wisconsin as your home state at this point?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely feels like home.
And you're in New York now. Do you feel like you missed Wisconsin so far? I know it hasn't been super long, I don't think.
Yeah, I miss it. I'm still missing it a lot, missing the friends and the people I knew there, but also just Wisconsin in general, the culture there. I plan on going back after I'm done with school here. And, yeah, because it is. I mean, Ithaca's nice. It's a wonderful place here, too. But it just doesn't feel like home. Moving around so much, I never really knew what it really felt like to have a place that felt like home, and now Wisconsin does. So to be away from it, I found myself missing it. So I hope to go back one day.
And part of that was you got your undergraduate degree at UW-Green Bay. Can you talk about your experience there?
Yeah, it was a great university. The teachers were always extremely helpful with anything I needed. They dedicated themselves inside and outside of the classroom. Their courses were amazing and gave me a lot of good opportunities to get active, either politically or with the community, through student organizations and so on. And, yeah, I mean, obviously it was good enough school to help me get into Cornell. So it was, I mean, when I look back, it really was a great school. Even a lot of the coursework we have at Cornell, I've noticed, it's rigorous, but sometimes I feel like it's not really much less rigorous than the classes I was taking in Green Bay. And I don't know if that was, you know, more pertaining to the actual program I had, the specific degree, or just the university in general. But I really do feel like it prepared me really well, made me a better person. It's just helped me so much now and just with being able to get to grad school.
Well, we're moving in closer to the brain drain topic now. You came down to two different options, Cornell, where you're at, and UW-Madison. Now, why those two?
They're both great schools. At UW-Madison, I was planning on going for a double major degree, which would have been in public affairs and urban planning. And, I mean, UW-Madison has one of the best public affairs schools in the country. And it was home to me again. You know, I could stay in Wisconsin. Madison wasn't too far from Green Bay. And I was familiar with Madison. I really liked it there, too. Then in Cornell, I applied to a program called Industrial and Labor Relations, and that was a single master's program. And I applied to that because that was one of the best industrial and labor relations schools in the country. And, it was Cornell, so having an Ivy League brand on your resume never hurts either. But what really pushed me to make the decision, Cornell was able to pay for my entire first semester of tuition, and then UW-Madison was only able to give me like $2,000 to $3,000 of grant money, which really wouldn't have even paid for a semester of school, and I didn't have any extra money saved up. I was already planning on working once I started grad school, but I just needed something that would pay for tuition. And that was a big part that pushed me to Cornell, since they could pay for my tuition. But also, I don't know, it did kind of feel, I mean, you know, grad school was going to be tough, the money was going to be tight, and I didn't want to be living in a place that was, that I had all these other unstable financial things to worry about, such as, is my school going to be, you know, how's the budget going to be next year? Is there going to be money for me to get grants or fellowships to be able to pay for school? And so just the fact that, I mean, there's obviously still different political workings happening in New York and Ithaca here, but, you know, there's no broad attack on the financial structure of the university. And so the fact that Cornell was not only able to offer me funding, but also I'd be living in a stable environment to be able to just focus on my graduate degree, and then hopefully be able to come back to Wisconsin and turn that into something good.
Talking to Paul Ahrens, UW-Green Bay graduate who's now at grad student at Cornell University, sees himself as part of a brain drain from Wisconsin. And let's get more into that point, Paul. You, as you mentioned, you saw the differing financial aid as part of a bigger picture, a symptom of a different priority on education here in Wisconsin. Can you talk more about what recent budget issues made you think about how the state thinks of higher education here?
Well, it was the budget proposal and the Wisconsin state budget for 2015-2017. It was proposed $300 million, but it later got changed to $250, which is still substantial, but a $250 million cut from the University of Wisconsin system. And, you know, I worked in student government at the time there, as well as other organizations that co-students as well as just community members would help out with. And we saw this, how these effects were already starting to ripple. I mean, there's some professors had either taken buyouts or just gone to different universities or schools for different reasons. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about which programs were going to, well, not necessarily which programs were going to have to be cut, but the programs were going to probably have to be cut, but which departments or which, how, you know, what kind of the way the money is going to be divided up among the schools. And, I mean, I wasn't there by the time it finally went through and started making real effects, but none of us thought it was going to be good. And I had heard that, you know, UW-Madison specifically, there's a lot of talk about what was going on there. They're going to have to start, you know, starting to increase the amount of out-of-state enrollment, and also cut back on the amount of grant money that they were giving graduate students. And that was one thing I read, so that's what made me suspect that the reason UW-Madison wasn't able to offer me a lot of money was potentially because they were preparing for the looming budget crisis that may happen. That was just something that stuck out to me.
Now, somebody listening, maybe not involved with the university system, might say, well, too bad we lost this grad student here, another student there, a professor there. Why should this be something, do you think, that people around the state should worry about, this wider brain drain issue?
Well, because it adds up. We don't know how great these if we're not talking about specifics, some of these professors we're losing, they could be some of the best professors. I mean, even in school at Cornell, I'm constantly reading papers or we're talking about studies in the past, things that were performed at the University of Wisconsin system. It's one of the best state university systems there is. And so when people leave, I mean, that's the people are the institution. It's not just formalities and rules, the constitution and bylaws. You know, it's the people who make it function from a day-to-day basis. And when we lose people, it adds up. And as I said, you know, I want to go back to Wisconsin, but I can't make that happen. I can do as much as I can within my ability to increase the probabilities, but at the end of the day, if there's no jobs in Wisconsin for what I want to do after I get out of school, I'm not going to be able to go to Wisconsin because I need to eat, I need to pay rent. You know, at the end of the day, we go where we can make a decent living and also live with ourselves. And if Wisconsin's losing students and it's losing professors, and these things are going to add up, and again, it's not even just the money. It's a sense of demoralization, a sense of feeling like you're being attacked, a sense that you feel like the people who are supposed to be leading you and taking care of you are not at all. That they, at times, it feels like that they don't even care, and So again, it's not, again, like people say that, you know, what, you put your morals on your budget or something like that. You put, you know, budget your morality. We've all heard kind of phrases like that. And it really became apparent that way. And I'm sure the people who support and the people who are advocating in favor of the budget believe that it was a good thing. But the way it was for people who didn't believe it was good, we felt attacked. We felt that our, the foundation of our community was being being hacked at. And that to me speaks much deeper than just, oh, a $250 million budget cut, you know, shared governance and tenure maybe be taken from state law, or even talking about the quantity of students and professors that are leaving because, again, you know, I said I came from a military family where I've moved at least 14 or 15 times in my life to different houses or different cities, and I know what it's like to not have that stability. And also that I know what it's like to feel like I have a home. And to me, the stability is what helps create the feeling of home. So without stability, I mean, there's, I don't know, it's hard to feel anything else that's really that great in life. I mean, stability is what we thrive on. I think it's underrated in our society.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
That was Paul Ahrens, a Cornell graduate student who says he's an example of Wisconsin's brain drain.
Coming up next, we'll hear what Wisconsin survey respondents had to say about who should pick the state superintendent of schools here in the state.
We've got more results now from the latest Wisconsin survey. Twice every year, Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and St. Norbert College ask Wisconsinites about their opinions and attitudes on political issues, including this year a question about how the head of the State Department of Public Instruction should be chosen.
Earlier this year, Republican Representative Joe Sanfilippo introduced a proposal to make the position an appointed one rather than an elected one. The change would require a constitutional amendment, meaning a majority of voters would have to approve the measure. And according to the Wisconsin survey, the support isn't there. 84% of survey respondents say they'd like to keep the position as an elected one versus 10% who say the governor should appoint the superintendent.
Here with us now to take a closer look at the results, how we got here in the first place, is Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
So a big majority, as we mentioned, of survey respondents say, hey, let's keep this job, the state superintendent of education, elected, not appointed, as some Republicans are calling for. What's your read on those results?
Well, you said I was going to take a closer look at it, and frankly, you don't need to take too close a look to see at 84 to 10 that there's overwhelming opposition to this idea, and you say, well, what's the margin of error? I don't think that's a relevant question in this case. So I think Representative Sanfilippo, I should add that I don't want to take a direct stand myself, but it's pretty clear he's out there in a pretty lonely position, which I find it hard to believe myself that the legislature can go forward with this idea facing that kind of public sentiment.
Now, this is something that maybe people haven't given a lot of thought to with the right framing, the right sales pitch, I guess, from someone who wanted to make that change. It's something that maybe would change the public's mind. But whatever it comes down to, the public would have to weigh in on this because it would be a constitutional amendment. So you think this would be a tough hill to climb, it sounds like.
Oh, any constitutional amendment is. It has to be passed by two consecutive sessions of the legislature, each house of the legislature, which generally means at least a two-year process, and then it has to go to a statewide referendum. Representative Sanfilippo insists this wasn't politically motivated, even though it's hard to escape the fact that the Republicans pretty much don't like the current state superintendent, Tony Evers, who is definitely, it's fair to say, aligned historically with the more liberal wing of things, the more education establishment wing, and you could even say Democrats, although it's a nonpartisan office. So he says this is just good government, that there'd be more accountability if the governor was picking the state superintendent. On the other hand, this goes back to the founding of the state in the 1840s, so it's not exactly a new idea to elect the superintendent, and people pretty clearly want to vote for their elected officials based on these results.
And this is a position that probably a lot of people don't think about or didn't used to think about that much. I think in a recent piece you had some trivia questions about the great state superintendents in Wisconsin history. But now, education, very polarized issue. This position gets a lot more attention. How did that happen? How did we get from, you know, kind of a quiet background job to something that is politicized?
Well, everything's politicized these days except for rooting for the Packers. In the case of education, I think you can sum it up by pointing to a few things. The rise of the private school voucher program, starting in Milwaukee 25 years ago this fall, and now it's available statewide. Just today, I saw some numbers suggesting there were 32,000 plus students getting vouchers to go to private school statewide this year. So that's a major change in the landscape and a highly political one. You also can't escape pointing towards Act 10 and the whole tumultuous events of the spring of 2011 and throttling. I don't know what word's the right word, but just about eradication of the powers of teachers' unions, which was a highly politicizing and polarizing event. And in general, the Common Core has become highly politicized, even though, frankly, I'm not sure how many people actually understand the issue. So education policymaking is more partisan. It used to be a kind of a classic, something you'd point to as a bipartisan subject, and that is no longer true.
Republicans have criticized the way DPI heads are elected, in part because, you know, it's a lower turnout election in the spring, these nonpartisan elections, and they say you've got a built-in constituency of teachers, people who work in education, who will turn up to vote for somebody favorable to them. So it's a built-in bias, I guess they say, toward a particular mindset of a DPI chief. Is that part of what Republicans here are worried about or trying to change?
Well, you could say that, and they do say that. I think you have to consider it is a spring. It's election in the spring of odd numbered years. 2017, April of 2017 will be the next general election for superintendent, with a primary in, I believe, February, if there are more than two people who run. Those are small turnout elections. It used to be a common criticism that the office was owned, so to speak, by the state teachers union. But you have to factor in that by 2013, when the current superintendent, Tony Evers, won his second term, spending by WEAC and the power of teacher unions had been greatly diminished. I try to keep an eye on real results and real politics, and the real results are that the, so to speak, more liberal or more teacher establishment-oriented candidate has won, I believe, at least the last five elections for state superintendent, and the one more aligned with conservative and Republican interests has lost, and usually by pretty decisive margins. So I think if I think if the Republicans had won some of those elections, they wouldn't be interested in the idea of getting superintendents in some different way.
Talking to Alan Borsuk from Marquette University, looking at the role of the state superintendent of public instruction, a constitutional amendment proposed by Republican legislators wanting to change that from a directly elected position to a governor's appointee. Well, let's talk about, Alan, the thinking behind that. You know, the Department of Administration head isn't elected, the DNR chief not elected. Why was this set aside, as you say, back born with the state, to have this position be elected separately?
I don't know if I know the history well enough. You're talking about 1849. even I wasn't around then, and I'm old. But it's certainly, education is a different matter. Education is such a common denominator interest statewide. It is a power that's vested primarily in state government. Local schools are, by law, extensions of the state on this, and always have been. And going back to those roots, the superintendent was supposed to be elected. Now, frankly, it was a extraordinarily low-profile position for all those years. It's become more high-profile, although I'm pretty sure Tony Evers could walk down the street with hardly anybody recognizing him. I mean, it's not like being governor. There's about a dozen or so states that elect state superintendents. There's a dozen or so that have governor appointments. There's the rest generally would have appointments by a state board of education. And that's an interesting piece of context here. Wisconsin is one of the only a handful of states that does not have a state board of education, something for kindergarten through 12th education that would be comparable to the Board of Regents for the University of Wisconsin system, and is the only state, I've been told, I believe this is a factual statement, it's the only state in the country that does not have a board of education, but does have an elected state chief education administrator. So we're kind of out there a little bit in a special category. Nothing right or wrong necessarily about that, but it does make Wisconsin distinctive.
You wrote about the back and forth over this proposal between the DPI and the sponsors of the legislation. What kind of things did we hear when this was first floated?
Well, everybody does things in the name of good government. Nobody's so Representative Sanfilippo, frankly, he's the only one I know of who's really been outspoken on this, and even Representative Voss, the Speaker of the Assembly, when it first came up, said, gee, I think people prefer to elect their officials whenever there's a question about that. So I'm dubious about how it's going to go in the legislature. I was dubious even before these results came out, but at 84 to 10, you're not going to see much. But I think Representative Sanfilippo has been arguing that this would be better government, there'd be more connection between the DPI and the governor's office, and more ability for a governor to respond to public opinion and appoint or disappoint a superintendent. Whereas Tony Evers, the current superintendent, used the occasion a few weeks ago of his annual State of Education address to say that this flew in the face of empowering the people of Wisconsin, that in a way that went back to the start of the state. So the rhetoric is pretty strong as to what would be more responsive to education needs and to the will of the people.
We're talking with Alan Borsuk about the latest Wisconsin survey results, looking at what people had to say about who should choose the next state superintendent of public instruction. 84% of survey respondents say they'd like to keep the position as an elected one, versus 10% say they like this idea of a constitutional amendment to have the governor appoint the superintendent.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of these results, and who do you think should have the power to choose the superintendent of schools in the state? And why do you think education issues have gotten more politically charged in recent years? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Alan Borsuk of Marquette University about the latest Wisconsin survey results, and we're taking a look at what respondents had to say about who should choose the state superintendent of schools. 84% of survey respondents said they'd like to keep the position as an elected one, versus 10% who say they'd rather have the governor appoint the superintendent.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Who do you think should be in charge of selecting the head of the DPI? Why do you think the state legislature and the DPI have clashed in recent years, and what does all this mean for the future of education in the state? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Nancy now in Appleton. Nancy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I guess I'm one of the 84%, or I don't guess it. I know I'm one of the 84% that feels that it should be decided in an election. And I'm very concerned about education in this state and some of the issues that I don't think have been addressed while all this is going on. I'm concerned with the voucher schools and the money that is taken away from our public schools. I'm concerned with all the power that our governor seems to be, in my humble opinion, seems to be trying to garner. And I don't understand his motivation whatsoever. And I would like those things to be more addressed, I guess, by him. But he seems to just brush off anything that doesn't quite praise what he's doing.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, you mentioned that voucher point as something that people are concerned about. It's a big issue at schools this year. Where does that stand now? Are we locked in where we're going to be for years to come, or is this still something that's a moving target?
Oh, there's lots of parts in motion, and that'll continue. We have a fairly stable and slightly growing situation in the city of Milwaukee where things started, which this fall is about 27,000 students, which is well over 20% of the total school-age population in Milwaukee that are using vouchers to go to private schools, the large majority of them religious. There's a couple thousand plus in Racine, and that program is in its fourth year and has no cap on the number of students who can take part, so it'll probably keep growing because it's still kind of youngish. And statewide, this year there's more than 3,000 students getting vouchers, and this is a that expansion is only in its third year. In the state budget that was approved in June, or actually it was into July by the time they approved it, there is a big expansion of the statewide voucher program. It's got a lot of rules and ups and downs of how to get into it and so on, many of which will melt away as the years go on. The cap on how many students can take part, which is now 1% of the students in any specific school district, will go up 1 point a year, and by 10 years from now will then be eliminated. I just spoke yesterday to the head of School Choice Wisconsin, Jim Bender, and he said that they've heard from, which is the main pro-voucher group in the state, I should add, and he said they've heard from literally hundreds of schools that are interested in taking part in coming years in the voucher program. So I expect on the statewide front, there'll be a lot of growth, and it'll be, very controversial, some really positive sentiment and some really negative sentiment.
And that's been a point of friction between Tony Evers at DPI and Republican lawmakers. He's perceived as, and rightly perceived, I think, as opposing expansion of vouchers.
Well, you'd get into huge discussion about that if you pursued it. The Republicans certainly think DPI is not a neutral party, is an anti-voucher party, and they have been responsible from the start in administering the program, but they can only administer what the law is, so they can't stop the growth within the limits of the law or they, whatever. If anything, I think DPI deserves some credit for being a break, and a good one at times, on doing something about some of the worst of the schools in the voucher program, which there are in Milwaukee. There were some and still are a few really terrible schools. I can't think of another word to describe them that's any milder than that. So the DPI people would say we're just enforcing the law, but I think there's not much doubt that you know, the vouchers were never Tony Evers' idea. And he has at times said the expansion of vouchers is being done in a way that is not fair to the much larger number of kids, over 800,000 who are still going to the traditional public schools. So to that extent, he's been a critic for sure. But just, are they pro or con? The DPI folks would say mostly they're administrators. And the Republicans would certainly say that's not the case. They're a hostile force. Kind of pick your point. You know, this 84-10 result, one of the things that's striking about it is on almost every education policy question, such as this woman was bringing up, the division is much tighter. And if it's voucher questions, if it's school funding questions, if it's what do you think of a variety of, you know, the Common Core I mentioned earlier, division is much closer to 50-50. It's very rare to see an 84-10 result on anything other than are you in favor of good education for children, which, of course, that would be 100-0.
Talking to Alan Borsuk from Marquette University about Wisconsin survey results on the state superintendent of schools. Who should pick that job, voters or the governor? As you mentioned, 84% say continue electing that post. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Nick on the line in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'll start out by saying that I absolutely do not want the governor to appoint the superintendent of state superintendent of schools. Absolutely not. Now, as far as watching politics, there are some of us who watch it all the time, and all we see is more and more of the things that the people would be trying to look for is being moved into under control of the governor. And we don't like that at all. the input of the people is just being absolutely choked off. And the last thing I want to say is that the vouchers program started out to be for low-income inner-city students, and the governor and his group there have slowly moved it over to making it available to people who can already afford to put their kids in private school.
All right, Nick, I want to give Alan a chance to jump in here. So a perception, Nick says, that Governor Walker is trying to take more and more authority in schools. Is that the perception, do you think, from people in those schools?
From people in the schools, like teachers and such?
Exactly.
I bet the answer is yes. I mean, teachers do, public school teachers in large part, best as I can tell. I've never seen exact results on this, but they feel kind of put upon, and you know, they're not a morale among public school teachers is not so great, best as I know. In this poll, the St. Norbert poll that Wisconsin Public Radio joined them on, you know, people were kind of grouchy, if I may say so, on the whole, and whether you think the state's going in the right direction, whether you think the nation's going in the right direction. Approval ratings for Governor Walker have dropped sharply in both this poll and in the Marquette Law School poll, which I actually work on a little bit, ever since he ran for president. So this feeling of we don't like what's going on and we're unhappy with Governor Walker has certainly grown and is an important force. I think it's really worth keeping in mind.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That was Alan Borsick, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. He joined us to talk about the latest Wisconsin survey results and what people had to say about who should choose the state superintendent of schools.